Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by Minnesota Public Radio for PRI. Well, today, beer takes on a new identity. We're going to be talking with Alan Eames. He's a beer anthropologist. He's been called the Indiana Jones of beer. He's a scholar and an explorer. Alan survived plagues, Montezuma's revenge, and has been held at gunpoint by guerrillas in his search for the almighty brew. Mark Bittman, who writes the minimalist column in the New York Times, takes on the lowly chickpea. Reporter John Kalish steps into the food world of mystery writer Kinky Friedman. And as always, the second half of the show is devoted to you. We open the lines for your calls, and you can reach us at 800-537-5252. So we're off. And let's get started with our mobile eaters, Jane and Michael Stern. They write the road food column in Gourmet Magazine.
Lynn, I thought I knew everything about cheeseburgers, but in upstate Connecticut, my home state, I found out something completely new. At a restaurant called Shady Glen, they have a way of making a cheeseburger unlike any I have ever encountered. A customer there named Pat Conger told us about it.
I've been coming to Shady Glen since I was in high school. And the best thing about it is there are big cheeseburgers. They have a way to do it. I've watched the girl on the grill. I can't make it work the way she does, but their cheese is crunchy and the burgers are juicy.
Lynn, it is the weirdest thing to see the way they make these cheeseburgers. I don't know how. I mean, I suspect that how they did it originally must have been an accident, and then it was like such a wonderful accident. They kept it. What they do is they put a hamburger patty on the grill. They take four regulation slices, maybe, what are they, 4 by 4 inches of American cheese, and they lay the cheese across the burger so the cheese is much bigger than the hamburger, and it melts around the patty, but then it sort of spreads out on the grill, and the cheese gets all like hard and frizzly, almost like Greek saganaki or something. It's not flambéed, but you get that kind of grilled cheese effect. And then the whole thing is shoveled onto a bun.
Oh, but wait, Jane, you're missing one very important step. Before it gets shoveled onto the bun, those kind of crunchy, firm edges of the cheese, which are bigger actually than the patty itself, get kind of folded up in a halo effect above the patty of meat. So the top of the bun really doesn't even fit. I mean, it'll set atop the cheese, but there's a huge space between meat and bun top that is occupied by this kind of firm, crunchy, chewy cheese.
Sort of like a tortilla bowl.
When you said crunchy cheese, what came to my mind was burnt. But this isn't burnt, right?
It's weird. It does not get burnt. We've tried to duplicate this at home, and that's what happens to our cheese. It burns and gets horrible. I don't know what, it's maybe the kind of cheese they use, or maybe the well-seasoned grill.
Yeah, need an old well-seasoned grill.
Is it like a raclette almost? I mean, it cooks on the grill, but it doesn't burn. That's the amazing thing.
What else have they got in this place?
Well, actually, cheeseburgers are the specialty, but the other thing is they make about 20 flavors of ice cream. And I mean, they really make the ice cream during the summer, whatever fruits are fresh. They make, you know, peach ice cream, they make blueberry ice cream.
And my favorite New England flavors, which are grape nut ice cream and frozen pudding. Those are like traditional New England flavors. Have you ever had grape nut ice cream?
No.
And I know it sounds like a diuretic or something, but it's actually wonderful.
And it's really a very old traditional New England thing. There's grape nut pudding and grape nut ice cream go back for decades in New England. And what happens is the grape nut cereal gets put into the ice cream, and because it's in this kind of cold, soft emulsion, it softens. So it's just like kind of streaks of flavored grain through the vanilla ice cream. It's a wonderful idea.
Shady Glen is such a kind of a remnant of the 1950s, as actually is the whole Berlin Turnpike in Connecticut that you take to get to it. You really feel like Archie and Veronica when you're eating there. I mean, it's so wonderfully corny. You know, at Thanksgiving they have pumpkin pumpkin flavored ice cream at Christmas. They have red ice cream with green cherries in it. I mean, it's so innocent.
But what does the place look like? I mean, ambiance is a very important part of our eating experience.
It's a wonderful, simple ambiance. Last time we were there, I tried very hard to take a photograph of the place that's in some way captured its 1950s innocence, and it was virtually impossible to do because it's so simple. It's got booths, it's got the kind of counter space where the waitress works her way among the booths and comes to the table. She pours the first glass of your milkshake from the silver beaker for you. And of course, there are about two glasses remaining in the silver beaker when she sets it down on the table. It's an old-fashioned dairy bar is what it is. That is the ambiance.
And I've never had one of those silver malted milk beakers put in front of me where I could resist drinking directly from the silver beaker and foregoing the glass.
Oh, how crude.
Thank you both, dears.
Bye, Lynn.
Happy cheeseburgers.
I keep drinking malted milk, trying to drive my blues away. I keep drinking malted milk, trying to drive my blues away. Baby, you're just as welcome to my loving as the flowers is in me.
Among their other accomplishments, Jane and Michael Stern are the authors of Eat Your Way Across the USA. You can hear them every week here on The Splendid Table, and you can get their food finds on our website at splendidtable.org. Our minimalist theme song for our minimalist cook, the man who can put together an entire Thanksgiving dinner in 4 hours, Mark Bittman. Mark writes the minimalist column in the New York Times and joins us here on a regular basis to help streamline our life in the kitchen. Hey, Mark, welcome.
Hi, Lynn. Nice to be here.
Mark, what have you been cooking lately?
You know, one thing I've been doing that I really have wound up liking quite a bit is a soup that relies on chickpeas for both its broth and for thickening agent. And it works great. You can soak the chickpeas or not. We can get into that later if you want to. Unlike most beans, the liquid that comes out of or the liquid that's created by combining water and chickpeas actually tastes really, really good. And of course, if you wanted to cook it in stock, it would taste even better. But cooked in water, it's quite delicious. And if you add aromatic vegetables to that, celery, carrots, onion, the usual, and some sprigs of thyme or chopped tomato or whatever, you have the basis for a great vegetarian soup. If when the chickpeas are done, you take them out and puree half of them or a third of them and then stir them back in, you suddenly have this really creamy vegetarian soup, which is quite nice. And then if you grill some sausage or something and cut it up and put it in the soup, you have an even better non-vegetarian soup. But maybe that's overkill for some people. I don't know.
Yeah, you know, the thing about chickpeas is they have that sweetness to them that a lot of beans don't. And they do make a great broth.
Yeah, it surprised me. I guess I didn't know it. I stumbled on it. I mean, it makes sense to me because you're right. They do have they're really different from other beans. But I always, or almost always, discarded the cooking water once they were cooked. And this time I didn't. And I tasted it and I was, it's actually quite delicious.
It's really, I can understand. It's really amazing. But now, how do you cook your beans? You mentioned that sometimes you don't soak.
Well, I think that soaking is a time-saving method if you remember to do it. But I can't, this must happen to you too. 4 out of 5 discussions with people about dried beans begin with them saying, well, I was going to have beans today, but I forgot to soak them last night, so I guess I can't.
Yeah.
And the fact is you can, you just need to add some percentage, it's not determinable really in advance, but some percentage of time to the cooking time. So soaking might save you as little as 10% or as much as 30 or 40% of cooking time, but not more than that. And chickpeas will cook from scratch in 2 hours or sometimes even an hour and a half. And if you soak them, they might cook in 1 hour. But so big deal.
You have to soak them for an hour anyway, or, you know, whatever.
Yeah, overnight, so, whatever. I mean, you know, the other piece of this puzzle is a pressure cooker, which will deal with any beans in about 40 minutes. So, but that aside, all cooking beans is about is rehydrating, really. And yes, soaking starts the rehydration process, but it's not indispensable. It's by no means indispensable.
But in a pinch, could we use canned chickpeas?
Well, my feeling is you could use canned chickpeas, although they're usually so soft that there's just no hope of any texture left at all. They're just on the verge of falling apart. And the stuff that they're packed in, and it's mystery liquid. I don't know what it is. So I think to use canned chickpeas, you have to rinse the chickpeas and then start with good chicken broth or some other good broth. In order to make this soup good. So I don't know that it's... You're saving a little time, but you're probably creating work by using canned chickpeas.
Uh-huh, yeah. Well, now walk me through your chickpea soup, the one that you do just with the water, you know, and the aromatics.
I put chickpeas in a pot with water, if I remember to soak them fine, if not fine. A lot of garlic, mashed or sliced, but not fussed over, not minced. And rosemary or thyme or whatever herb you feel like, and, you know, water, and cook until the chickpeas are pretty tender, which is an hour or maybe two, adding water as I need to add water. And then I take out the herbs and I put in the aromatic vegetables, but celery, onion, carrot, then I can add some salt and pepper too, and I cook until those are soft but not mushy. I mean, we want them to be good to eat. We don't want to take all the flavor out of them. And then I puree a third or a half of the chickpeas and stir them back into the soup and season it. And it's a great soup to finish with extra virgin olive oil. It is also a great soup to stir some meat into, whether it's leftover meat or freshly sauteed or grilled sausage or roast chicken or whatever. But it's not totally not necessary.
Sounds good to me, Mark. Thanks a lot.
Always a pleasure.
Mark Bittman writes the Minimalist column for the New York Times and is author of How to Cook Everything. You'll find Mark's recipe for chickpea soup on our website at splendidtable.org. Now, I'll tell you what I'd do with that soup. I'd give it a shot of vinegar. Vinegar is a great flavor enhancer, and I don't think we give it its due. A shot of sherry vinegar would give chickpeas a whole new dimension. You know, before the balsamic craze, sherry vinegar held the spotlight for years. For me and most Spanish and French cooks, it never went out of style. It's as good in sauces, soups, and stews as it is in salads. Sherry vinegar is aged in wood barrels and tastes a little like almonds and oak. There are a lot of different sherry vinegars out there, but you should look for vinegars that are from Spain, obviously. You know, having a collection of vinegars is like having a bunch of great scarves to spark up your wardrobe. Just that single touch makes a dish taste new. So check out sherry vinegars when you get a chance. We have one up on the Splendid Table store. That's splendidtable.org. Well, coming up, the Indiana Jones of beer. Eat, drink, and be kinky. Kinky Friedman, that is. And open lines for your calls. The number is 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio for PRI. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show devoted to life's appetites.
I live my life without a care. I cross the road with nettles in my hair. And people ask me why.
of us think about this much, but every food has a story to tell. Take beer. And today's guest. Alan Eames is obsessed with beer. Not just tracking down beers most of us have never heard of in places most of us would think twice about visiting, like countries at war or mud huts in the middle of jungles. Alan Eames is a historian and a beer anthropologist. He's spent a lifetime researching beer's relevance to civilization. His research spans 40 years and 44 countries. Alan's newest book is Secret Life of Beer, and he's joined us today by phone from his home in Vermont. Alan, welcome.
Thank you.
How long have you been studying beer?
40 years. Beer has been went from a hobby, an inquiry, into an obsession almost. Terribly neglected and misunderstood beverage, and very, very significant in the story of mankind.
Why do you say that?
Well, beer is perhaps the single greatest dietary discovery ever made by humankind. Its role as a food was tremendously significant. If you have to look back to the time when we, most of us, were hunter-gatherers, wandering from place to place, catching what we could and harvesting what wild grains happened to grow, by taking beer, and by taking grain, rather, and turning it into beer, the magical process increases fourfold the nutritive value of the raw grain. Alcohol is a preservative, so in effect what you had was a liquid bread that was non-perishable. And in addition to altering our mood, making us feel good, dietarily it was very significant. And some have proposed in the realm of anthropology that the discovery by women that if you take grain and put it into a gourd, put some water in there, leave it in the sun, and it'll turn into a beverage that tastes pleasingly sour and makes us feel good. That focus on feeling good and altering mood was perceived as religious and spiritual, and people were quick to decide, let's not ever be without this. Consequently, perhaps people began to settle where wild crops of cereal grains were, and civilization may have been born as a direct result for mankind's hunger for mood alteration.
So were women the first ones to make beer?
Yes, there's an extraordinary story here, and that is that women, beer is the most feminine of beverages, and in all ancient societies and in all today's non-technological societies, the story is that beer came from a goddess, never a male god, and until the age of Industrial Revolution around the middle of the 19th century, beer was still exclusively the domain of women, and I discovered as an anthropologist that women maintained power and status in male-dominated hunter-gatherer societies through their skills as brewsters. And I've seen this all over the world, from Mongolia to Africa to Central and South America, among tribal people. And the tale is that mankind was given beer out of pity from a goddess, because we're the one animal knowing every day of our lives we are doomed to die. And legends and mythology say that makes us the only mentally ill animal. Consequently, out of pity, the goddess gave beer to the daughters of men. And this became an enormously spiritual business, tremendously powerful, tremendously important to us as a species.
Well, it gave us intoxication. Is this
yes, it did.
It?
Yes, it did. And uh-huh. Intoxication is what we are doing in our history. The beer-drunken person was considered to be under the influence or possession, if you will, of a spirit or a goddess. And that this connection was between the world of the living, the dead, and the spirit world. And so drinking, abusive drinking, what we would call abusive drinking, was seen as a religious ceremony. And it was consequently fraught with religious stories and beliefs and power. And tribal drinking was always overseen by an elder brewster, a priestess, if you will. So it was a different thing than we see today at a college frat party.
So you don't say there really is a connection between the college frat party and the ancient religious ritual?
No, we've lost that connection. When you take the ceremony out of a ritual, when you take the spiritual sense of awe, devotion, and respect away from an object, then it ceases to be of any value at all, except as an escape, if you will. And that's sad to me.
When you're actually working in the field, where are you going?
Well, where I go, places, for example, countries like Peru, you have two areas. You have the jungle lowlands, the Peruvian-Brazilian jungle, where you have tribal people making masato or manioc beers. And then you have the highlands in the mountain regions, the most remote areas, where the Quechua Indians make fantastic beers from corn and strawberries.
Corn and strawberries,
yes,
together?
Yes, and these beers called frutaladas are as bright as Elvis's Cadillac. I mean, they're tremendously pink, bright, shiny beers with enormous complexity of flavor. They're beautiful. And these beers are made by women who don't have a clue what they're doing. They have a notion of magic. Everything is magical. Every step in the brewing process is performed to appease the spirits of the dead or to curry favor with the Earth Mother or the Corn Mother. All of these things. I mean, they don't have any idea. For example, a modern brewer will put finings, powdered sturgeon bladder, for example, into beer to draw particulate matter out of the beer, rendering it clear.
Uh-huh.
The Quechua woman will put in lumps of charcoal. But why? She says, well, this is to keep the spirits of the dead out of the beer. The result is the same. But in Western society, it's technology. For these people, it's magic. In one expedition into Amazonia, I had been traveling for a number of days to reach a village, and I was kept hearing people I would encounter along the way about this wonderful grandfather's beer. And I thought, my God, there goes my entire thesis, which is that beer is always made by women. And I got to this village, sure enough, there were these people, and they were delighted and very hospitable hosts, and I was offered this beer, told grandfather's beer, grandfather's beer. My interpreter was unable to find out where's the guy, the granddad, who made this wonderful Masato manioc beer. I was drinking it. I noticed it was very gritty, and I was very ill at ease because I thought, I want to meet this man. Finally, I found a man in a non-technological society who's making beer, and it turned out that what I was drinking was a beer made by women, thank God, but with grandfather in it. It contained the cremated bones of this very esteemed member of a tribe. So I was somewhat taken aback, but once again, my theory held fast.
Uncle George's beer!
Exactly.
Good Lord. Well, Alan, good luck on your next adventure.
Thank you.
Alan Eames is author of The Secret Life of Beer and founding director of the American Museum of Brewing History and Fine Arts in Fort Mitchell, Kentucky. Alan's beer musings got me thinking about Brussels. So I've got a recipe for you for a classic Belgian stew. The Belgians are past masters at cooking with beer. They've produced nearly 300 different artisan beers. This recipe is for a Brussels pork carbonade, a stew made with a rich dark beer and spices and finished with snappy, tart little cornichon pickles. Now, you can get the recipe two ways. Either mail a self-addressed stamped envelope to The Splendid Table, care of Minnesota Public Radio, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55101. That's The Splendid Table, care of NPR, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55101. Or take a look at our website. That address is splendidtable.org.
There is a place where you can go, where Marilyn's still dancing with DiMaggio, and Juliet with Romeo. And the name of the place is love.
They put their Kinky heart. Friedman first made a name for himself as an irreverent country singer and songwriter. He then went on to reinvent himself as a writer of mystery novels, each one featuring the exploits of a country singer turned amateur detective named Kinky Friedman. He fills his books with his real-life friends like newspaper reporter Mike McGovern. Well, recently, McGovern came out with a book of his own, Eat, Drink, and Be Kinky, a cookbook for Friedman fans that has recipes from the characters and places in Kinky's books. Confused? Well, fiction meets reality when reporter John Kalish recently broke bread with McGovern at some of Kinky's favorite New York haunts.
It's hard to miss Mike McGovern in a crowd. He stands 6'3" tall and weighs more than 200 pounds, though he recently shed some 70 pounds after abandoning what he calls the Chicago diet of starch, grease, and preservatives. Readers of the dozen Kinky Friedman novels will remember him as one of the Village Irregulars, a group of real-life people who serve as the Kinksters' many Watsons.
I've been cooking for years, since I was a kid. I started cooking for my mother when she was working three jobs. And I found out as I was growing up, cooking is the faster way to a woman's heart. I visited Kinky several times on the ranch, cooked for some of the gang at the ranch in Texas. And he liked it. Everybody liked it a lot. And the legend grows.
The recollection I have of reading many of these books is that for Kinky Friedman, it's a never-ending series of espressos in the morning, cigars during the day, and shots of Jameson.
Right. That's right. Kinky has been in the forefront of mystery writers writing about food and restaurants. He's way ahead of Sue Grafton, Robert Parker, James Lee Burke, Sarah Paretsky. All these people are now writing about food and restaurants, but Kinky was way in the forefront of these people.
McGovern is joined by Steve Rambam, a real-life private investigator who also appears in the Friedman Mysteries. In the books, Rambam employs serious weaponry and many illegal feats to assist Kinky Friedman. He's quite proud of the time he performed the Heimlich maneuver and perhaps saved Kinky Friedman's life during a Sunday brunch in Kerrville, Texas. There's a recipe in McGovern's book from Rambam for a dish called jailhouse chili.
It's been gathered over the years. I've interviewed a lot of people in jail. I've had the pleasure of seeing the inside of a few jails myself. It's an amalgamation of recipes.
And what's in it?
The primary characteristic of it is it's ingredients that can be easily obtained inside jail. You can always count on a marginally corrupt guard to bring in some ingredients.
You actually make this recipe from time to time?
Not only do I make it, this is a world-renowned recipe. I can tell you, when I'm in Texas and I make this, people have been known to drive 3 hours in from Houston to eat this chili. And I'm from Brooklyn, so this is the ultimate compliment in Texas, that people will drive more than an hour to eat your chili.
Welcome to Myers of Keswick in Greenwich Village. This small British grocery shop is nirvana to many of the estimated 150,000 Brits living in Manhattan. The owner is Pete Myers, a former roommate of Mike McGovern's. He, too, is one of the Village Irregulars.
I'm very surprised at the amount of European fans of Kinky's that somehow find their way into this store.
Ah, we've come from Sweden. We read about you in the books.
The recipe attributed to Myers in Eat, Drink, and Be Kinky is roast beef with Merlot sauce. The homemade sausages in his shop have quite a following as well. To an American, the imported stuff in this store is a bit strange. There's something called mushy peas and a baked beans product made with beans grown in Michigan or Ontario and then processed in the UK, which means these beans have crossed the Atlantic twice. I see cans of Heinz curried beans and Heinz mulligatawny soup, and then I come upon something known as haggis.
It's a sheep's stomach filled with a variety of offal and oats. It's quite tasty if you pour enough whiskey over it.
Across town at Wing Wong, a no-frills restaurant in Chinatown that serves Hong Kong-style Cantonese cuisine, perhaps the most colorful of the Kinky Friedman characters is nursing a bad cold with a steaming hot bowl of wonton soup.
I like to be referred to usually as Larry Ratso Sloman, because there's something about the Larry and the Sloman that bookend the Ratso that gives it a little more dignity.
Here at Wing Wong, another Kinky Friedman hangout, Sloman is spearing the wontons in his soup with a chopstick and dipping them into a small dish of green ginger sauce. add an order of spare ribs and a 2-liter bottle of Diet Cherry Coke, and you have the other components of Ratso's Big Wong Dream, a recipe in Mike McGovern's book that entails no preparation other than carrying takeout fare back to your apartment. It's a meal he frequently eats when he rendezvous with Kinky.
Kinky manages to eat maybe 15 meals a day. He's got a very quick metabolism, and he also is always in need of other people to bounce his problems off of, because he's the most self-obsessed person in the world. Kinky will go out for breakfast with me, and then McGovern will call, and he'll go for like kind of a snack at 11, and then he'll go for a lunch with Rambam, and then he'll go for an afternoon snack. I mean, the guy eats every 2 hours. But he can't cook, and I can't cook. McGovern could cook.
Kinky Friedman apparently concurs with that assessment. In the foreword to Eat, Drink, and Be Kinky, he calls Mike McGovern the best cook he ever met in his life. The book is published under Simon & Schuster's Fireside imprint. Among the recipes you may want to try at home are Willie Nelson's surprise brownies, Ratso's White Castle omelet, and a beverage known as Vodka McGovern. For The Splendid Table, I'm John Kalish in New York.
Mike McGovern's cookbook is Eat, Drink, and Be Kinky. You can get the aforementioned recipe for Steve Rambam's Jailhouse Chili by going to our website at splendidtable.org. I must admit, it's quite a recipe. I mean, listen to this. I quote, "Trim the beef of fat and cut into thumb-sized pieces. If you don't have thumbs, use your neighbor's for measuring purposes." Unquote. Okay, it's time for our weekly trivia challenge. It's a cooking question and a neat trick to know. How would you get an accurate measure of fresh herbs before you chop them? Here's what I mean. A recipe calls for, let's say, a tablespoon of minced parsley. Usually you make a pile of leaves, you mince them, and usually you end up with less than you need. So you have to start all over again and do double the work. So our trivia question is there a way of measuring an amount of fresh herbs before you start mincing? We'll be back with the answer and your calls in a moment. The lines are open at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio for PRI. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. We're taking your calls this hour at 800-537-5252, but before getting to the phones, I've got the answer to this week's trivia question. It was a cooking question. Here it is. How would you get an accurate measure of fresh herbs before you chop them? Now, here's what I mean. A recipe calls for, let's say, a tablespoon of minced basil. Usually what you do is you make a pile of leaves, you mince them, and then you measure them. And usually you don't have enough. So you have to start all over again and do double work. So our trivia question was, is there a way of measuring an amount of fresh herbs before you start mincing? Well, the answer is, of course there is. And here's the trick. Take whatever measure you need, let's say a tablespoon, stuff the uncut leaves into it until they're level, really pack them in, then mince. You should end up with a tablespoon, maybe on the generous side, but never shy. So you'll never have to do that double work again. Speaking of fresh herbs, the best way to store fresh herbs is to freeze them. I know when you think about preserving herbs, you think of those picturesque bundles hanging from the rafters of farmhouse kitchens. Trust me, if our ancestors, at least the serious cooks among them, had freezers, they would have been freezing herbs from day one. Freezing protects most of the fragrance and the goodness of herbs. Think about the difference between fresh rosemary and dried. It's like two different herbs. Well, rosemary freezes like a charm. Soft leaf herbs like basil tend to darken and get mushy, but usually you use frozen herbs in dishes where the herbs will darken anyway. So here's how to freeze fresh herbs. Wash and dry the herbs. Strip off the leaves of most of them. You could leave thyme and rosemary intact because their leaves hold on nicely. Pack the herbs into heavy Ziploc bags, press out all the air, seal, and put them in the freezer. They'll keep beautifully for 6 to 8 months. And to use the herbs, don't defrost them. Just break off what you need.
If you're feeling sad and lonely, there's a service I can render. Tell the one who loves you only, I can be so warm and tender. Call me, don't be afraid, you can call me. Maybe it's late, but just call me.
The lines are officially open. It's my favorite part of the show. The number is 800-537-5252. Give us a call. We'll give a shot at anything you want to talk about. Let's get right to it. We have John on the line. John, what do you want to talk about?
I want to talk about carrots.
Oh, this is my husband's favorite vegetable. What do you want to say about carrots?
When I lived in France, we used to have, as a standard, a carrot salad. And it was carrots that were cut up to be like small matchsticks.
Right, right.
An inch and a half long, maybe 2 inches long, and very thin.
Uh-huh.
And I guess in the same manner that French cut beans enhance the flavor of the beans, these were not cooked, but they were easy to chew, very tasty, served typically with a Dijon vinaigrette, a mustard and vinegar salad dressing.
Uh-huh.
And I have, and we'd buy them in the store in, I think, kilo bags, so a large quantity of these all pre-cut. And I haven't found any way to get that cut to prepare my carrots that way.
Well, first of all, if you want to get that super sweet flavor, I find carrots are an example of buy organic. I think there just seems to be a real difference between organic and conventionally grown carrots. I just seem to find the organic ones generally sweeter. The other thing is you can either cut them yourself.
Oh, now there's a task.
Oh, no, it isn't. Not really.
This
Not really.
Thin, a matchstick, a wooden matchstick?
Yeah, no, listen, no, stay with me.
Okay.
Okay, stay with me. The way you do it is you peel the carrot. And then you cut it, you just put it down, you make a little cut all the way down one side so it's not going to roll when you put it down on top of your counter.
Mm-hmm.
And then you take your knife and you cut long, thin strips so they look like ribbons.
Mm-hmm.
And then all you do is stack up the ribbons and cut the ribbons into thin strips and then just cut the strips the length that you want them. And that's the way julienning, it's called a julienne. The matchstick is referred to as a julienne, as you probably know, in France. And that's the way it was done by hand for a long time. But there's a couple of other ways now of doing it. If you have a food processor, some food processors have an attachment you can buy that will do that. And there's also another instrument called a mandolin. Not the musical instrument. It's a slicing tool. And they're produced in France, they're produced in Japan, kitchen shops would have them. And they usually have an attachment also where you're just sliding the carrot over a blade that cuts them in that shape. And that's probably what was being done in the kitchen of restaurants that were producing this. You know, this can be done by machine. So that saves you the handwork. And obviously you know how to do the Dijon vinaigrette.
Just combine the two till you're satisfied.
One of the things is there's usually shallots or garlic in there.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, wine vinegar, salt and pepper, good olive oil, and a coarse-grained mustard.
Mm-hmm.
And usually that's moutarde de Meaux. Isn't that a great way? Moutarde de Meaux. It comes in a crock, and it's coarse mustard.
Cut
your carrots, and then let them marinate for a while in that dressing, because the vinegar in the dressing, the acid in the dressing, is one of the things that softens up the carrots a bit.
Oh, I thought it was primarily the fact that it was cut in that shape.
No. It's the action of acid on the carrot.
Ah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay?
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Have a good day.
You too. Sandy's calling. So, Sandy, what's on your mind?
My husband bought me a copper clam steamer for Christmas, and I'm really excited about using it, but I don't know how.
You're going to have to explain what it looks like.
Okay, it's about 12 inches in diameter.
Yeah.
Looks like a big clam shell. It has a hinge on one side and a lock on the other.
Mm-hmm.
It's hammered copper, and it's Portuguese. And I really would like to use it to steam mussels, and I've never made mussels, but I love them, and I'd like to steam mussels in it and maybe have get a recipe or two for a wine preparation.
It's lined with tin, I would imagine, right? Or some kind of metal? It's not copper inside.
Correct.
Yeah, it has a lining.
Yes.
I've seen pictures of these, but to be frank, I've never cooked in them, and I don't really know what classically would be put in them. Of course, the Portuguese are famous for their clam dishes. So maybe it is like you put clams in clam, if you follow me. But you could probably do mussels, as long as this is, if it's liquid tight.
Okay.
Because the deal is mussels will throw off a great deal of liquid. And you don't want it dripping out, you know, the sides of this thing.
Do you think you would put it in the oven or on top of the stove?
I have a sneaking suspicion. If I remember correctly, it's like two equal sides, isn't it? It's not like one side is very deep and then the other side is shallow.
No, that's correct. Two equal sides.
I would imagine the oven is probably a real good place for it.
Okay.
It's probably going to be the safest place. But I have a sneaking suspicion originally this might have been used in a way where you cooked on one side, flipped it over, and cooked on the other, too, on top of a stove. But if you want to do mussels, here's the deal. Start out with buying your mussels from a source where you know they come from non-polluted waters.
Okay.
That's absolutely the single most important thing other than freshness.
Okay.
The mussels have to be alive, which means if their shells are slightly open and you tap it, they'll close right away. If they don't close, don't buy it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Now, the next thing you do when you get home, scrub them really well. Remove any beard. You know, sometimes they have little like shreds of things coming out from between the shells. That's their beard.
Okay.
It's called. Trim that away. Give them a really good scrub. And then you want to get rid of the sand in mussels or clams. I mean, they tend to be a little sandy. So what you often do is you cover them with cold water in a bowl. You sprinkle it with cornmeal.
Okay.
Or flour. And you stick it in the fridge for about 3 or 4 hours. And the mussels purge themselves. The little guys absorb all of that. They leave the. And when you look at the bottom of the bowl, you're going to see sand. And that'll also plump up the mussels.
Okay.
They'll get nice and, you know, plump and juicy. And then all you have to do is put the mussels into the bottom of the clamshell and don't crowd it too much.
Okay.
And I would do some chopped garlic with them. I'd sprinkle them with a little white wine. I'd put chopped parsley in there and maybe a little chopped shallot.
Okay.
And if you wanted to get spicy, I'd put even a dried chili.
How much liquid would you put?
I wouldn't put more. If you have a pound of mussels, I wouldn't put more than a quarter of a cup of liquid because, as I remember, this is not a very deep container, right?
No, it's not.
And remember, they're going to throw off more anyway. And then I'd seal it and I'd put it probably in a 400-degree oven.
For about how long?
Oh, boy. Now, this is the tricky part. Because what you want to do is make sure that the mussels are opened, but they're not overdone. If we were doing them in a closed pan on top of the stove, it would be maybe 10, 15 minutes, and we'd be checking them. But in this case, I'd say what I do after about 15 minutes in the oven, I take it out, open it very gently, use mitts so you don't burn yourself, and see if the shells are beginning to open. And once they're open by about an inch, you're just about done. If they're not open, seal it up and put it back in the oven.
Okay.
Okay, and if not, and whatever doesn't open, throw that away.
Okay.
Okay? Now, it sounds like you're needed there, though, Sandy, so thanks for calling.
All right. Thank you, Lynn.
Okay, take care.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
You know, speaking of copper, I realize that a lot of times we go to garage sales and we see these old copper pots there and we say, wow, they're cheap and I can get a great pan for next to nothing. But let me explain something. If you see the copper inside the pot, don't by the pan. Now, let me explain why. The pan would have to be relined. You can't cook in copper unless there's a lining, because copper reacts with certain foods, and it can be toxic. I mean, this can really be dangerous. And when you get into lining those pans, it gets real expensive. So when you're buying a used copper pot, make sure the lining is really intact. One other piece of advice. I'm hooked on discount places, but you'll see a lot of discounted new copper pots. They're selling real cheap, but let me tell you, they're not a bargain. If the copper's real thin, and if the handle's made out of brass, this is really an inferior pot. The brass handle get very hot, and thin copper doesn't conduct heat all that well. There's no benefit to it. The way you can tell if the copper's the right thickness is it should be about an eighth of an inch thick, and the handle should be cast iron. If you've got that, you've got a good copper pot. And the reason why people are so crazy about cooking with copper pots is that it's one of the world's greatest heat conductors. It spreads heat beautifully, and the neat thing about copper is it heats up fast, but when you pull it off the heat, it cools down fast. And for professional cooks, when they're making a delicate sauce, that cooling down is as important as the heating up. It's the Rolls-Royce of pots. Okay, that's the copper story. Let's get back to the phones. The number is 800-537-5252. We've got John on the line. So, John, how are you?
I'm fantastic today. And how are you?
I'm fine. It's good to hear somebody's fantastic.
Yeah.
What's on your mind?
Chocolate and meat.
Together.
It's crazy. Well, if you can have surf and turf and you can fry ice cream, why not chocolate and meat?
Well, you know, you're right, because have you ever had mole?
No.
In Mexico, there's a famous sauce. In fact, it's considered to be one of the great sauces of the Mexican kitchen, and it's called mole, M-O-L-E, and it's often served with turkey. It's festival food. It's like Christmas dinner food, and a lot of people make mole sauce and serve it with chicken or with pork, and it has many different kinds of chilies in it and spices, and it has bitter chocolate. And that gives it a kind of depth that's really wonderful.
Sure.
Now, So you want to know ways of using chocolate with savory dishes?
No, I just was more interested in the meat factor of it. My wife and I were having a debate on the way home from the airport, and we were listening to your show, so I called. And, so I'm thinking, I've gone as far as to, grind, chocolate really fine and put it over the top of like a portobello mushroom.
Yeah.
Which worked for me anyway.
That's an interesting.
Crazy,
never would have tried that. What kind of chocolate?
Just a sweet chocolate.
Sweet chocolate on portobello?
Yeah, just real fine, like almost like a salt or something of that nature. And it worked for me. Just real light. Just a difference in taste, I guess. And when you heat chocolate, it changes flavors, too.
That's true. And most of the things I can think of that are traditional where you have chocolate and meat, the chocolate is bitter chocolate.
Right.
It's not a sweet chocolate. But, you've brought up a good point. Why not a sweet chocolate?
Sure. And, like, when I eat chocolate with ice cream, I'm always more into the cold and the ice cream than I am the actual chocolate.
Well,
it's like to me.
Yeah, and cold numbs flavor anyway.
Sure.
You know what? You've given me an idea. I wonder what would happen if you took something that was very rich and had a sweet undertone. I'm thinking of something like lobster or scallops.
Yeah.
And, I'm just thinking out loud now. Follow me on this one. What if you did a sauté of lobster tail or really great-tasting scallops in a little butter, which is rich, but just a little, with orange zest, which is bitter, and you finished it with a little orange juice that you reduce with a little bit of broth and just a fine thread of bittersweet chocolate over it.
That might work.
I think I think that really might be interesting.
Well, I like to mix and mingle foods, taboo things you shouldn't do. But I remember one time I put barbecue sauce or something of that nature, a barbecue to a fish.
Oh.
My roommate thought I was nuts.
Did you like it?
Yeah, I loved it.
Well, then it worked. I'm going to try very fine shaved chocolate on grilled portobello and see what happens.
Yeah.
Hey, thank you. Thanks for the ideas.
Uh-huh.
Interesting.
Thank you.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
We've got Scott calling. So, Scott, what issue do you want to discuss?
Well, I'm a basic, run-of-the-mill, good Midwesterner, and I love a good rhubarb pie.
That sounds pretty neat to me.
It's wonderful. And I make my own recipe, but I have a little problem with it.
Uh-huh.
The filling is runny, and I need to know how to get that thing to firm up even when it's warm.
When it's warm, it's kind of tough.
Yeah.
You don't ask easy questions. what have you tried that you haven't liked?
Well, I've tried using flour as a thickener.
Yeah, yeah. It usually doesn't cook enough, right?
Well, it makes it a little more pasty, and I don't it so much. I have tried, unflavored gelatins.
Mm-hmm.
But then that works fine when it's cold, but...
Real mess when it's warm, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Yeah. Have you tried cornstarch yet?
No, I haven't.
Okay. One way to do this would be, because this is what I do for, like, berry pies, mm-hmm. which are very juicy, like blueberry pie.
Oh, yes.
You figure for every cup of the fruit, a teaspoon of cornstarch. So, like, if you have 5 cups of rhubarb in your pie, mm-hmm. you'd use 5 teaspoons, level teaspoons of cornstarch. And you toss that in when you toss in the sugar and whatever else you put into the pie.
Mm-hmm.
So it's completely distributed.
Okay.
And what happens is cornstarch, when it simmers in liquid, immediately thickens that liquid. If you've ever done Chinese cooking, it's the key to, think about it. All those sauces in Chinese stir fries are thickened with cornstarch.
Yep.
It thickens instantly. And when it's cold, it stays pretty thick. So even when your pie is warm, it'll still run a little, but it will be thicker.
Okay.
And it doesn't give any taste off.
No, not yet.
And it cooks fast because one of the problems with pies is that if you put something like flour in, sometimes that pasty taste is a lot of times just uncooked flour because it hasn't cooked long enough. See if that works.
I will do that.
Okay.
Bye.
Well, we're out of time for today. Thanks for calling and thanks for listening. You know you can call us anytime. The answering machine is also eager to hear from you. The number is 800-537-5252. Have a great week, and in the meantime, let me leave you with a thought from Kinky Friedman, who wrote, and I quote, "May I remind you of the words Naomi Judd told her children when her kids were growing up. She said, wash your hands and say your prayers, cause germs and Jesus are everywhere." To get information on any of the guests you heard here today, simply mail a self-addressed stamped envelope to The Splendid Table, care of Minnesota Public Radio, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55101. That's The Splendid Table, care of NPR, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55101. Or take a look at our website. That address is splendidtable.org. And while you're there, take a little browse through the Splendid Table store. It's right there on our homepage, and all the proceeds go to support this program. The Splendid Table is produced by Sally Swift with Jennifer Russell. Our technical director is Jennifer Lukey. The Splendid Table is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed nationwide by Public Radio International. Be sure to join us next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
PRI, Public Radio International.